tell, we in industry have more problems putting these equipments on than the government. We don't do as much talking. Werner, thank you. I kind of feel like the late show coming on after Johnny Carson, after Walt's performance here. I also kind of feel like the late show is a look around. They see a lot of bleary eyes. I begin to wonder whether you're going to last through the late, late show or not. I think you should notice another thing, which you in industry probably secretly have been thinking about for a long time. Namely, if you look at the ratio of the help we get on these programs, there are 4 government people to 1 in industry. So I'm not sure how significant this is in the space program, but we're very anxious to change this ratio. As Doug Lord was saying, it's probably because of the way that the space program is going that I'm one of the last few people in industry who's left working on in space. The budgets have decreased at the rate they're going, that maybe at next year at this time you'll see 5 government people up here speaking and nobody from industry. Seriously, though, I'd like to speak to you as a member of industry, and I'm sort of curious right now as to whether we in industry in the space field are speaking to ourselves when I talk to an audience like this. How many people here are associated with the space program in any way? Would you put up your hand so we just get a feel for it? Well, I think you'd be interested knowing it looks like it's less than a quarter, and I think Werner and the rest of us are very pleased at that kind of a ratio, because I think the message that we would like to leave is not to talk to ourselves about the space program, but rather to people who are interested because you're American citizens and the value that the space program has to all of us. You know, the way the world is going and the way the country's going, I think all of you heard during the campaign that Nixon had, he talked about the forgotten man, namely the 80% of the people who have a reasonable good income and are enjoying some of the comforts of our American country. On the other hand, if you read the papers, and I'm afraid maybe the congressmen read those papers too much, they get influenced by the vocal minorities. And whether we like it or not, the vocal minorities are the areas that get the support. And I'm speaking to all of you to enlist your support to become a vocal minority that the space program is very important as to where I think our nation is going. And I'm speaking now not as a profiteering corporation man, but rather as an American citizen who has children who I'm raising for the future and who has had a lifetime of working in advanced programs. And I must tell you that, far as I'm concerned, I think the space program offers one of the shining lights of our present civilization and showing us a way to the future that stimulates broad-gauge thinking. And I think all of us have to recognize that we can't get so beset with the problems that we have of poverty and racial intolerance, the problems of campus strife. These are important and we need to solve them, but at the same time we have to keep a goal in front of us, which is a big step and is making us recognize that the universe we live in is a real fascinating and it's a real challenging part of our lives, and we need to be doing those kinds of things which make it possible for us to probe into these areas. Now, with that kind of a philosophical discussion, I'd kind of like to launch forth into the prepared portion of the talk. I feel very deeply on the subject, and I wanted to take the time to tell you that, because for the past decade, we have made remarkable progress in space. And I think all of us believe, or I should say the preponderance of us believe, that we will, in fact, land man on the moon this year, and that he will return bringing back for the first time in our lives parts of another planet for us to investigate. Now, I think the thrill of this is that we now have widened the horizons of our activities, and this widening of our horizons impacts every one of you. And that it impacts not only your technology, but it makes a tremendous difference on our educational system as well, and also the kind of government industry educational team that gets developed. Now, the reason I'm interested in the space station is because I believe that the space station is the next logical step in the evolution of a space program. As Doug Lord showed you, we've gone through the initial steps of learning how to exist and to do minimal types of activities in space. I think that we're at the point now where we can open up space to a wider variety of activities and also a wider participation than we have had in the past. And I think this wider participation is going to be one of the most important facets of a space program, because it's the identification of each one of us in our professions that makes the proper environment for the progress to be made in those areas. It's darn hard to make love at 2,000 miles, and I think the kind of an activity we're talking about, you need to be involved totally, and your interest needs to be involved totally, so that from that kind of stimulus spring the good ideas of tomorrow. I don't believe that Thomas Edison discovered the electric light by sitting in his research laboratory and getting ones and zeros coming to him over a data link. I don't think Newton invented the concept of gravity at long distance. I think most of the basic developments upon which we build our concepts of physics, chemistry, depend on firsthand knowledge of the investigator, and that, I think, is a kind of a facility we need to develop in space so that we can now start to try to use the characteristics of space to improve our lot here on Earth. Now, when I talk about a space station, I'm talking about a research center in space. Now, I'd like to emphasize that because I think one of my observations for having spent a few years in Washington is that we are rapidly becoming, our progress is rapidly becoming channeled by the budget people. And that in itself, whereas we have to all learn to live within the budget, it's a damn difficult kind of environment to create free, long-range thinking. Freewheeling long-range thinking, wherein you try not to put the constraints on the good ideas and try to identify, well, what value is it, but rather to provide the environment around which great ideas can grow. And one of the problems we have for a program such as the National Research Center in Space, or the space station that is in the vernacular, is the problem that NASA has been trying to come up with a series of experiments which you could assign a budgetary analysis to and say it's worth the effort to do all of those experiments. And I think this is a most difficult thing to do. You've seen our people in defense struggling with this kind of an effort in their cost-effectiveness studies. I think in most of the other civilian-type activities that have come about, most of the major developments have not been developed based on cost-effectiveness. And consequently, we have to approach a national research facility in space as in the same kind of a framework of thinking, as that it's good for the nation and that the nation can't afford not to go move forward into an area where we know how to go and in which there lies a great deal of promise for the good of the nation. Can we have the first slide? Now you can see that industry also changed the format, and we have a different way to project our stuff. It just happens we're out of step. This is a form that NASA uses most of the time, and I didn't recognize that they would use slides today. So, can we have that first slide? Now, the reason I'm putting this slide on is to show you that in one table, the kinds of activities that would go on in a space station. And if you go down the list, you can see there's high energy physics, space physics, industrial applications that Werner spoke about, solar astronomy, and the rest of the list. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is for two purposes. One is to indicate that there is a broad variety of fields of interest in which activities in space can be meaningfully accomplished and that have a great potential for the future of our country. For instance, in high energy physics as an example, most of you are well familiar with the program that this nation has in developing linear accelerators of greater and greater capabilities. Well, as you start to try to approach the higher velocities, the cost of a linear accelerator starts to approach that of a single space flight. And that in space, there exist high energy particles, which with the proper kind of laboratory equipment, you can use in the same manner that you do a linear accelerator. And consequently, we're starting to open up a new, a step function that's a quantum jump almost in the kinds of velocities that we can use in the study of high energy physics. Now, the other thing that I'm showing here is that in space there is a requirement for three kinds of environments. One is a remote environment, remote from the station, and that's true in the stellar astronomy and Earth observations. And the reason you would like it remote from the station is that man, in his usual well-ordered manners, is going to pollute the environment around the space station by outgassing of the station in various ways, and that since the tremendous seeing capabilities that we're looking for in astronomy would be impaired by any type of molecular activity in that area, it's going to be incumbent on us to want to move the sensor away from the station as opposed to leaving it nearby and trying to control the pollution. There's an analogy there that's not too different from some of our problems we have here on Earth. The other thing is that it's obvious that most of these fields of activity require a zero-G type of an environment, and that they also would, in many cases, like an artificial gravity in order to make living and living up in space a little easier to do as far as acclimating the experimenter, and also for the day-by-day activities which come about, so you don't have to design special-purpose equipments to take care of every one of man's functions. And you can see down at the very bottom, we feel that if we designed the right kind of a space station, we would have very important personages wanting to go up into space as well as astronauts as well. Can we have the next slide? Now, this is my simple-minded approach to how the space program should evolve. And if you've seen Doug Lord's chart showing you go from Apollo to the Apollo applications, we would believe that lunar landings would continue and that this would lead to some sort of a lunar exploration. However, I do believe that as we talk about lunar exploration in any depth, there ought to be a place in Earth orbit where we develop the equipments and the subsystems that will be used to support lunar exploration. And that is part of a space station, where you develop power sources that will last for long periods of time. The environmental control system, the data and information management systems, all of these tend to have somewhat the same requirements, whether you're exploring the moon or whether you're going to go to a planet, as far as their type of function is concerned, and they have some of the same type of characteristics of long-term operating capabilities. Now, the space station that is shown there is the early one that Doug spoke of, which is launched in the mid-70s, leading to a space research lab, and I think you have to look at this problem continuously backwards, namely, we need to keep our eye on the development of a research facility in space and then keep asking ourselves as to how that space station, that the early space station that's being developed, will grow readily into that kind of a capability. It's like designing a new laboratory complex. You decide what the goal of the complex is and then talk about building each one of the modules leading up to it. Can we have the next slide? Now, as we talk about this future research facility, these are some of the characteristics that we would expect we should be planning on. Large non-astronaut crew, and artificial gravity. I firmly believe that a research facility in space will have an artificial gravity section, because I think we're talking about functioning of people up there of a normal variety, and this will require some type of an artificial gravity. Now, Wally is quite correct. We talk about an artificial gravity, you do create some new problems, like the Coriolis effect. However, I'm quite confident that there's been enough data accomplished showing that if you stay down below 2 revolutions per minute, that the Coriolis effect starts to become of a not too much concern. And since there have been enough experimentation done with crews at RPMs up to 10 revolutions per second, and have shown that people can adapt to this with a little bit of training, I do believe that the Coriolis effect, whereas it will be a problem, is not insurmountable and will not, in fact, stop us from having an artificial gravity station. I show nuclear power because we're talking about megawatts of power, and that a station, just like any major facility in space, is going to be determined by the amount of its utility will depend on the amount of power that's available. And I think the rest of the systems there are shown, have been discussed by some of the previous speakers, so I won't dwell on them. The next chart. And I'll show you a couple of early concepts, and the only reason I'm showing you a couple of concepts is because we happen to believe that in the early stages of a space station program, that the artificial gravity, or the combination of zero and artificial gravity, should be built into the program from the initial parts of it, because we believe that the investigation of the artificial gravity levels should more nearly become part of what's now called the AAP program, in which we're trying to understand what the constraints on man operation in space are. Now, this may be a play on words, and it may be it makes more difference as far as the budgetary classifications are concerned. On the other hand, I do believe that if we're going to go into a space station program, we ought to do it right, and that going to an artificial gravity is going to be one of those types of prerequisites. Can we show that? Incidentally, here, the artificial gravity is primarily the habitability areas where they live and their supporting laboratories are. Those are the two arms on the side there. I can figure out how to run this darn thing. There we go. This is the habitability areas. This is a zero-G area. And I think the characteristics we show here for the zero-G area, namely that's going to be a bigger area than the habitability area, is going to be true because there's more activity in the early phases to be done in zero-G than there are in the artificial gravity. Can we have the next slide? Another concept of the same thing is this, which more nearly approaches some of the other pictures shown. Namely, this is the zero-G core, which is first launched, and then you add to it the habitability areas. There are enough different schemes on how you do this to convince me that it's not a matter of technically feasible. I'm sure it's technically feasible. We're going to have to determine what's the best approach considering all the other constraints on the program. Can we have the next slide? Now, if you look at the research center in space, I think this represents one concept that was shown earlier, where the habitability and the living quarters, the supporting laboratories are in these spokes, and then the center core shows the major areas of experimentation in zero G. This shows a nuclear power plant as part of the total station. Can we have the next slide? We've been doing quite a bit of work trying to decide which is the way for the future growth of these modules. I think we're tending to believe more and more as we look into the problem that this circular wheel type of an arrangement is more adaptable to the kind of program which could grow within the budgetary type constraints that the government will operate in. Now, the reason I say that is you can see starting in with a zero gravity station, you can start adding habitability modules to the thing as shown here, and then we start adding more and more of the habitability, habitability and research type facilities either around the periphery or at the core. And this allows you, as you have varying degrees of budgetary levels, to pace your program to determine how you add additional activities to the station. Again, I think the lessons we're learning here on Earth, namely when you're building a research facility wherein the future is not too well defined, generally you're better off trying to select a large area or a large campus type area to which you add buildings as the need develops. And also this provides one other feature which we think is going to be important, namely you're able to have traffic around the different modules without changing the gravity field of the equipment or the people who are involved in making that kind of a transfer. And then one other thing, as the traffic gets larger and larger, you don't want to have everybody trying to go through the center part, or you tend to have some of the same kind of problems you have in any congested area where you try to run everything through one point. Can we have the next slide? Now, I'd just like to make, I'll show you two quick slides here, and the only point I'm trying to make to you is this, that so far in our manned space equipments that we've been using in part of the Apollo program, we have been emphasizing reliability and also minimum weight. And in doing so, looking at the CO2 reduction system, we ended up with a system that ended up with 109 parts. Each one of these represents a certain function, a valve or a regulator or something of that type. Now, to have the next slide. We're confident as we start looking at things like space stations, one of the things you need to do is to reduce the number of parts and try to make these parts more rugged and more easily adjusted or maintained. And looking at that same CO2 system, providing all the same type functions, we were able to reduce the parts down to 30. And in doing so, we doubled the weight. But we believe for a program such as a space station that weight should come second, durability, maintainability, and the low cost should be of more import than that. Now, can we have the can we turn that thing off? Now, the reason I think all of you should be interested in the space program is because it has served as a tremendous motivator to have better electronics. I'm not an electronic engineer, but I've spent a good portion of the last 2 years for Grumman going from one electronic company to another, trying to get them to do better and to improve their products, their methods of construction, their methods of quality control, and just simple things like Wally was mentioning on switches and relays, that it turns out that it's a very difficult problem to assure ourselves that you don't have a switch, a thing as simple as a switch, that the contacts don't fall off or that there isn't a connector on the inside that's likely to shake loose if you vibrate it. And I have seen in corporation after corporation where after they have gone through the blood, sweat, and tears of setting up a quality control program and a method of inspection and also a method of screening these equipments, they immediately begins to open their eyes on how these same techniques could be applied to improving the quality of the product that we use for commercial usage. Now, it doesn't mean you can have a one-for-one exchange of these methods, because in most cases we have screen these things to the nth degree and would be probably uneconomic to use exactly the same techniques. However, they have in many cases shown that by improving of the quality control in a manufacturing process, you can affect cost reduction in the product line, which is aimed at civilian uses as well. The same thing held true in the miniaturization of equipments, and I think Dr. Jones gave you some examples how miniaturization of equipment resulted from the space program. So, in conclusion, I'd like to emphasize again to all of you that you have a stake in the space program, and it's a stake in making sure that the environment that the American industry lives in is one of a major forward thrust across the board in the field of electronics, materials, structures, management, and that it takes a program such as a space program to channel the interest of the nation, and that it's, I think, a specious argument to say, is it worth doing in space as opposed to some other area of endeavor? I have yet to see what this other area of endeavor is, and until a better goal comes along, I'd hate to see the nation lose the one at which you're making such good progress. I thank you.
We are running awfully late, so we suggested here between the five of us that we will not continue a discussion among the panel members now, but rather entertain questions from the floor. So why don't you start shooting?
Ron Weindel, Bob Cunningham. I'd like to fire up one of you. Apollo 7 was the mission you were involved in. That was essentially the Apollo command module checkout, if you will. 8 went around the moon, 9 checked out LEM. 10 is going to be lunar orbit and LEM checkout. 11 is the actual touchdown limited exploration. Now, where do you fit in this program? Or am I touching on something that's classified? Are you going for
there's
lunar
nothing.
Landing?
This is not... Yeah. Hello? This is...
It is.
It is.
It is.
Hello?
Yep. No, it's not classified because there's nothing classified about our program. However, right now I'm heading up our office's AAP effort. And unless something changes down the line, I'll probably fly when AAP flies.
Could you tell us how long it takes for a human being to adjust to zero G? I mean to say how long it takes to lose this impression that he's falling.
The question is, how long does it take to adjust to zero G? I think that's obviously going to be a subjective thing. I can only give you my personal impressions, and that is that with the exception of a certain feeling of stuffiness in the head I don't know when it left me, but I was aware that there was a feeling of heaviness in the head for maybe an hour or so. I felt like, it's a great place to be. Our whole crew, as a matter of fact, adjusted essentially that way, and apparently... it's been different on each of the flights so far. I think we can expect to see a wide latitude of adjustment due to the fact that you've got a different environment now. People are moving around, and you've got subjective responses to it.
I'm wondering, since 2 years, why...
It's not you, it's him.
Make advertisement for the space that we have to go into the space to utilize the solar energy for power aims here on the Earth, and beside of these for weather modification. No other power will do it, only the solar power. And I believe very firmly that the people at the NASA know it. If I know it, they must know too, but why they don't tell it? Because the simple common man will understand. We have to go to into space, then we can utilize the solar energy. And to get the hardware, we have to go to the moon, because very probably the hardware for this, the 100,000 tons of material, we have to manufacture on the moon. This is what I don't understand.
That's not
Matt. Hey, Werner.
Hey, Werner.
Are you guys all cowards?
Hey, you know, give you a good example of just this thing you talked about one of the last...
Repeat the question.
Yeah. Hey, the question was, why doesn't NASA spend more time advertising the fact that going into space... is the logical place to use solar energy to modify weather, as an example. And he wanted to know why NASA doesn't do it. And I was going to give him one example of the kind of thing that happens when you try to do this. Because one of the schemes I had before I left NASA was to put in a great big mirror in the sky in which we were going to illuminate portions of the Earth where you wanted to have some light during the night for whatever purpose you have. You never heard such a commotion come from the astronomers who says, you mean you're going to pollute the sky and we can't look at the stars anymore? So as soon as you start talking about modifying or changing anything, you immediately probably create far more problems than support you ever get out of the thing. So you really have to try to make progress without antagonizing too many people. That's one of the problems NASA has.
You know what? For example, you have the hurricanes. If you can direct the hurricane away from the mainland into the ocean, then what would probably increase?
Yeah, Fidel may object, though. We shoot it his way.
As you presently visualize the place of the station, space station, what would be the likely altitude and period of orbit?
The most logical altitude for a space station is probably around 200 nautical miles, because that's the compromise spot between getting the best resolution of things that you're looking for on the Earth and still keeping the drag fairly low, and doesn't get you into any radiation belt problems either. As far as inclination, for Earth resources, we want at least 55 degrees inclination. 90 degrees would be better. From the standpoint of logistics, obviously 28 degrees is the best because it requires the least amount of boost thrust.
What about the period? Would that be?
Any of those would be an hour and a half. Any of those would be roughly an hour and a half period.
In the entire space program to date, have you ever had a meteorite penetration in any of the vehicles? And if so, what provisions are being made take care of this in long missions?
Maybe I should field this question myself, because we developed the so-called Pegasus micrometeorite satellite at the Marshall Center for specifically that question. We need, of course, engineering data to see how thick you have to make a shell to make it micrometeorite proof. This whole thing is fundamentally a statistical proposition, of course. It's the kind of a thing where you can specify, I don't want more than one chance in 1,000 to have one penetration per year or per 10 years or per 1,000 years. And then you will want to know how thick do I have to make my shell. In order to answer this question, we built three so-called Pegasus micrometeorite collection satellites, or counting satellites. These things had surfaces exposed to the environment of approximately 300 square foot each. The surface was subdivided into panels, and each panel consisted of a sandwich, an aluminum plate on top, a KelF insulator in between, and a copper plate underneath. There was a 40 volt DC voltage between the aluminum plate and the copper. The idea was every time a micrometeorite would puncture the aluminum plate, there would be an instantaneous formation of plasma created by the evaporated aluminum, which would shorten the capacitor, so to speak. And the instantaneous voltage breakdown of that particular panel was then registered by some electronic device which told the ground, in essence, which panel had been punctured. Now, the aluminum plates were of various thickness so that we could also got a handle on statistical distribution of micrometeorites with a certain penetration capability. We were not able to see from which direction they came, nor how big they were, nor how fast they flew, but we could say they did indeed penetrate an aluminum plate of, say, 1/64 of an inch thickness, and so forth. Now, these Pegasus, all three of them were successful, and all three counted for over a year
the micrometeorite count in a typical 200-mile orbit. They were actually a little higher and gradually descended a bit, but that's not too important. All three also produced pretty much the same data, so that there is a feeling of consistency in the data. It's, of course, hard to express in one single figure what all this amounts to, but we can see this much. With a command module of the Apollo, you can stay in orbit for something like 10 years before you have to fear even a penetration, and such a penetration will by no means be fateful, because most penetrations will be amount to very small pinholes. The service module and the LEM are substantially more sensitive, but here again, penetration is not necessarily lethal. We found one thing that is very interesting and will be used extensively in future space stations. In fact, even our first AEP wet workshop will have that feature. We will use a so-called meteor bumper. This is essentially a very thin metal plate that will stand off about 2 inches from the pressure vessel itself, that is to be kept pressure tight. When this outer bumper is hit by a meteor, it will evaporate the meteor so that only a plasma jet will hit the pressure vessel underneath. And this plasma jet will already expand in the vacuum of space, so that whereas the micrometeorite may be the size of a grain of salt, that plasma jet has already a surface, covers a surface like this here. And of course, its penetrating power will be very, very small. With this feature, you can save a lot of weight. In other words, it's a good idea with meteorites not to build one armor strong enough to take them, but have a standoff sheet and then the actual pressure vessel. And with this meteor bumper, we can build a space station to all intents and purposes puncture-proof. I might add that there are, of course, some very big meteors in outer space, but I would say the chance to be hit by any one of them is few and far between. You might as well be hit in this room by one. So.
Are you talking about something that's a prototype of a manned system, or are you talking about just an unmanned satellite itself?
Manned probe.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There was one scheduled for Monday, which was delayed several days.
One is on its way.
No, I don't believe that's a lander, and it's also the second in the series. They've already launched one unmanned satellite en route to Mars. This is the second one, I think, so they can work some joint experiments with it.
Well, unmanned satellites have been sent to the planets by both the Soviet Union and the United States. The Soviets have not, I think, only missed one opportunity in the last several years. And these essentially come at Mars every 2 years and to Venus about every 19 months or so. So there are continually programs of this type.
Astell, you had a question?
Yes, Dr. Van Braun, you mentioned the possibility of international cooperation in terms of the manning of the space center. Is there anything in the works as far as the United States is concerned for getting together with the Soviet Union to explore these possibilities?
Well, the general posture of the United States with respect to international cooperation in the space program, that very definitely includes the Soviet Union, is one of cooperation on the basis of reciprocity. And, of course, some of the smaller countries cannot clearly and obviously reciprocate very effectively, but they can reciprocate in handling at least some elements of the program in their own universities or industrial plants. When it comes to the Soviet Union, where we have, by and large, a match, I mean, they have a very great space capability in every respect entirely comparable with our own, we would really like to have complete reciprocation. Now, in some areas, the Soviet Union has indeed elected to reciprocate quite extensively. For example, in the field of meteorological satellites, where there is a Soviet program to establish a long-range weather forecasting system, the Soviet Union was greatly interested in the output of our meteorological satellites like the Tyros family. And when this question came up and reciprocity was requested, they promptly volunteered, yes, we will make data on cloud formation and the like taken by Soviet satellites available to the United States. So on that basis, a very fine cooperative system has developed. Now, in some other areas, this reciprocation apparently isn't available. For example, in the field of launch vehicles, the Soviet Union has elected to be still quite secretive, clearly because of military implications of that part of the program. And so in that field, there is very little. I think no American has ever seen their launch sites. And Soviet citizens coming to this country, even when they are occasionally extended an informal invitation to come to Cape Kennedy to attend a launch, usually refuse because they say we cannot reciprocate, and we know that under the international agreements this would only cause embarrassment, so they don't come. But the welcome mat is out, let me say this.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ramon brings me to another question. Long range, what is the long range implication of using Earth observation satellites observing other countries' forestry, crop conditions, other types of things that you observe? What are there any steps or any thoughts given along these lines about, say, a nation's privacy? Are they right?
Doc, maybe you want to handle that. Write a book on that one.
Yeah, obviously, serious considerations and discussions will have to be taken on those. The precedent is well established for overflight with satellites, both by the Soviet Union and the United States, and is recognized by the UN treaty that for peaceful purposes this is acceptable. And I think the certainly some negotiations will have to be made as to exactly how such information is distributed, and I think the UN will play a key role in doing that. But at the present time, we are only looking forward to really research work in these areas. We are not talking about any operational system.
I think it's significant to note at this time that when you're talking about manned spacecraft, the inclination of our orbits is such that we really don't, we get up to just maybe touching the Mediterranean, and we never really come across Soviet territory as such. However, all of their flights are of an inclination that they cover the total United States, and I don't know that we've complained in any way, shape, or form.
Yep.
Yes. I have a very interesting question in our relations with the Soviet Union, because we have now the so-called
peaceful coexistence, is that the word?
Thank you. Time of coexistence.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now we have to think about the post-coexistence world. And I would call it the unified world.
Yeah.
And now this means that we engineers, we have to go a little bit more into the society. Because the engineers, they apply science to practical life. This is our, this is not the task of the scientist. It's not true, this is it.
Yeah.
It's a task for engineers. Although we must have not only biomedical engineers, but we shall have lawyer engineers, business engineers, and political engineers. And here now comes in this question, in relation with this question, overlooking the Earth.
Yeah.
Who possesses the Earth? Maybe all the human together is possessing all the treasures of the Earth. And this is because, you see, if you begin to make a little philosophical deduction, what is proper? Believe on the Ten Commandments, you don't steal, or believe on Darwin, survival of the fittest, or we believe on
I have the feeling that not everybody in the room understands you, sir, so maybe this becomes a little bit of personal.
Yeah.
No. Can we can we go? All right. Mm-hmm.
Europe, and somehow I see the space program is really attractive. But I don't know how small companies, especially Europe, can take part in all of this. Can you explain me or what kind of relations with European companies on the program? How small, countries are developed? I'm particularly from Yugoslavia. How we can contribute to the space program? We are not really now in this program, but how?
Well, NASA has cooperative programs with a total of, I believe, 47 different countries all over the world. Of course, they are bigger, smaller, depending on the resources that the particular country wanted to spend. And all these programs are of a cooperative nature, where the participating country assumes a certain portion of the responsibility and also a certain portion of the burden. Now, some countries, like the United Kingdom, like France, like Italy in particular, have very energetic space programs. Others have spent most of their money on the ground, for example, communication satellite systems and so forth. But NASA has an international office, and I think whenever a country seriously plans to explore these possibilities, the thing to do is to write to the International Affairs Office of NASA and just find out. They will probably send you a big set of pamphlets telling you about the ground rules.
Is that about right?
Our
Apollo 8 mission came off beautifully. I mean, they circled the moon for several orbits and came back fine. But what would happen if, for some reason, they couldn't get out of lunar orbit, or in the future, couldn't get off the moon? Is there any preparation for rescue in any way, shape, or form?
I think Walt ought to answer that.
Well, it's plain and simply, and readily apparent in that particular example, more than any we've had in the past, if you don't come out of lunar orbit, you die there. And I try to put out that rather matter-of-factly, because I feel like in the Apollo 8 case is the first situation where the American public, whether he was involved deeply or not with the space program, it became readily apparent to him that there were things that could go wrong which were uncorrectable. And I think that you ought to understand and be able to carry back to other members of that general public that in spite of the fact that it became obvious to almost any schoolboy that something could happen if you didn't get out of lunar orbit, that we still don't consider that the most critical portion of any flight. The real critical portion, as far as that goes, is during boost. That exists on all missions. I think that what I would like to leave you with is the fact that we attempt to reduce the risk every place we can, that there are some places where the risk becomes maybe glaring to a person that's not up on the total picture of the space program. However, the primary and fundamental thing is to reduce the risk, and when you can't reduce that risk to zero, as you can't just driving across town here, then the thing to do is to understand where the risk is. From a crewman's point of view, I don't mind taking certain risks as long as I know where they are, when I have my neck out, and even more importantly, when I'm back on nice, safe ground again.
We have one more question.
Sir, yep. I'd like to ask one question about the radiation factors in outer space. More or less, Mr. Cunningham probably knows about radiation in outer space more than anyone else, and directing this to him. Mr. Cunningham, according to the newspaper, there are three X-rays, they say, equivalency of a trip from here to the moon and back again. Is this true, or is this a what misprint of the newspaper?
Well, your exposure to radiation in a trip from here to the moon and back has got to be dependent on what kind of solar activity occurs during that particular trip. Now, we are right now actively engaged in pushing our lunar landings. If you follow the solar cycle, you're also aware that this is also near a solar maximum right now. By some strange quirk, we end up putting up our solar telescope in a time frame which is probably near a solar minimum. But at any rate, the problem you have is limiting total exposure. I think unless you're faced with any kind of a Class 1 flare, that you're going to have an exposure which is roughly equivalent to a couple x-rays. There's no big problem at all unless you have a solar flare occur during one of these missions. There are plans underway, incidentally, to be able to predict solar flares even better, and that's a difficult task in itself. Also, if you are able to predict a solar flare, even with a short amount of warning, the procedure is one where you orient the predominant portion of the spacecraft towards the source of the flare and take advantage of what shielding you can in the hardware. Somebody else here might be able to add something to that.
Well, I can only add that on the outbound leg, when you have the advantage of a fully loaded service module with you plus a fully loaded LEM, if you do what Walt just said, turn all that hardware towards the sun. So in the command module, you have the advantage of the shielding from all that fuel plus your heat shield. Even a very sizable solar flare does not raise the total exposure above critical levels. On the home stretch, the degree of protection is less good for obvious reasons. You are now minus the LEM and your service module is almost empty. But some people say that the risk really having a critical exposure during that return trip is about as great as driving to the launch pad the day of the launch.
Can you do that in 8 minutes?
Driving to the pad? No.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to adjourn.
I think we spend enough time now. It is 10 minutes of 5, and I suggest we adjourn.